Case 96 from the Book of Serenity. Zhuefeng's disagreement. Yunju didn't rely on relics, the jewels of discipline. Zhuefeng didn't admire sitting or standing death. Nuito didn't need the birds to bring flowers. Huangbo didn't envy sailing on a wine cup across a river. But tell me, what is their strong point? The case. Zhuefeng worked as an attendant of Shi Shuang. When Shi Shuang passed away, the community wanted to invite the first rank monk in the hall to succeed to the abbacy. Zhuefeng did not agree. He said, "Wait until I have questioned him. If he understands our late teacher's meaning, I will serve him like our late teacher." Then he asked the chief monk. The late teacher said, "Cease, desist, spend 10,000 years in one thought. Be cold ashes, dead trees. Be like a censer in an ancient shrine. Be a strip of pure white silk. Now tell me, which side does this illustrate?" The chief monk said, "It illustrates the matter of absolute oneness." Zhuefeng said, "Then you still don't understand the late teacher's meaning." The chief monk said, "You don't agree with me? Set up some incense." The chief monk then lit the incense and said, "If I don't understand the late teacher's meaning, then I won't be able to pass away while this incense is still burning." So saying, he sat down and died. Zhuefeng then caressed his shoulder and said, "As far as dying seated or standing is concerned, you are not lacking. But as for our late teacher's meaning, you still haven't even dreamed of seeing it." And the verse. The school of Shi Shuang was personally transmitted to Zhuefeng. Passing away in incense smoke, the true bloodline cannot go through. The crane nesting on the moon has a 1,000-year dream. The man in the snowy room is deluded by the achievement of oneness. Cutting off the 10 directions still gets a failing mark. Quietly move a step, and behold a flying dragon. So once again, we dive into the tangled underbrush of our life. Of course, this is our way. Though we would like to take the high road, all of us, to sit and manifest some illusion we have, some idea. Each one of us has some idea about what this awakening means, or how we will be someday. But we are encouraged again and again, and encouraged through this wonderful koan curriculum, which is one tribulation after another. We are encouraged through that koan curriculum and through the content of our very life to enter here. This, I think, is the most astonishing teaching of Zen. Of course, the teaching we can all nod our heads sagely when we hear it. Oh, yes. Enter here. Sure. I vote for that. But then comes the boredom and the restlessness. Then comes the anger. Then comes the confusion, the desolation. So, how about then? Can I change my vote? So, of course, this is the way it is, and the appearing of the Dharma is ceaseless. The vast generosity of this world we live in. When we catch glimpses of it, tears fill our eyes, and a gratitude rises in us. Because for a moment we see that all along it has not been us. All along we have not been alone. This delusion of separation, this delusion of me and you, subject and object, good and bad, appears as clear as day. And as we were saying yesterday, the stories that arise in us to explain who we are, to fixate who we are, we begin to see how painful these stories are. Whatever we hold on to, no matter how beautiful, how precious, whatever we hold on to will cause us pain. Because we live in a world of arising and passing away. We live in a world where the seed sprouts and the plant grows, the flower blooms, and then the flower dies. So it is with me and you. So it is with mountains and rivers. This whole universe blooming and passing away. So the so many points to enter in here, but thinking as I was reading it of Zhuifeng's insistence. Of finding out, of testing. On one hand, this kind of testing we can see as well, who does he think he is? Who gives him the authority? But the wonderful thing about this practice of Zen is that the teaching is that the authority comes from each one of us. So though we may play the role of teacher or head monk or Eno, we may play the role of student, chopper of vegetables, server of tea. In the arising of the Sangha, there is an equality that supersedes. These roles are only temporary and provisional. And the Buddha's final words were, "Be a light unto yourself." So all of these teaching, all of this blabbing away that happens from the front of the room, is not what you should pay attention to, but rather it is your own heart and your own experience. And this is quite a dangerous thing, to come forward as ourselves. So often we are trying to assess the situation and figure out who shall I be? How do I make it through What do they want? And I think in our practice, in some way, as Dogen said so beautifully, that we turn the light within. And then the question is, what do I want? What do I really want? And answer after answer, well, I want my legs not to hurt. I don't want to be angry. I don't want to be in pain. All of this arises. But it appears that no one of us is in charge of our life. That as we sit in stillness and as we move through the world, we do truly encounter the 10,000 joys and sorrows. And though we might prefer to have the birds fly and drop flowers around us as we sit, we might prefer the state where things are clear and where we are not trapped and held by our resentments, where we are not enslaved by our opinion. But whatever our preference, our life comes and finds us. I loved yesterday how we referred to how on the retreat there are these moments of clarity and we the synapse closes and we go, oh, now I see that if I just breathe very slowly, everything will be okay. And so we try breathing slowly, and for a while it's pretty good. Yes, I'm having a good afternoon. And then at some point, of course, it starts not to work quite so well. So, oh, I'll breathe a little slower. Or maybe it's a little faster, I can't remember. And then the grasping comes up. And then we find ourselves tumbling down into the darkness. We find ourselves deconstructed once again. And when I first began Sesshin, I had the great fervent hope that at some point I would learn how to do Sesshin correctly so this would not happen. And then once I learned it well enough and could do it, then I would have the fantasy Sesshin of deep concentration and great joy. But what I have found instead is that this clarity and confusion, this joy and sorrow, this equanimity and disturbance come and go. And that the problem when the dissolution comes, the problem when everything falls apart, is actually not the falling apart. Falling apart is just falling apart. But the problem and the true suffering is my scrambling to find the firm footing. My scrambling to be right and to understand and to find some way out. There is no way out. So though we might say this head monk lost in his desire to be right, to prove, he dies as the incense burns. in some ways, this is the great invitation for each one of us to die into our life. The instruction of the late teacher to cease and desist, to spend 10,000 years in one moment, in one thought. So we are practicing the skill of ceasing, the skill of not doing, the capacity to let things be, which we cannot engineer. We cannot strategize, because that is another form of doing. So we practice moment by moment with what is arising. This moment, we say, contains everything that is needed to awaken. And I was struck once again as we read our friend Chinul, our Korean ancestor, talking about sudden awakening and gradual cultivation. The usual way we might think of this is just the opposite, that we gradually cultivate, come and do this, and that at some point then we have this sudden awakening. But Chinul, in fact, maintained that it is just the opposite, that no one of us would be here if there had not been some awakening that had already happened. Each one of us has tasted something or glimpsed something or been hit over the head by something had a sense that we come here because we know something. It may be quite clear and in focus, or it may be some vague longing. I thought I could. I thought there was something. What? And so we come here and we practice out of this awakening. Now, this awakening is not something wild or special or saintly or spiritual or anything. All human beings have some intimation of this. Of course, it looks different with each of us. But there is some, this is this inner knowing. This is this sense that that keeps us here. Of course, you know, we're here and we've really got ourselves into quite a mess, right? Here we are sitting hour after hour. No escape. And yet, for some reason, each one of us keeps choosing to stay. Even when we're certain that it's a pile of hooey. That is certainly not true, or if it is true, then it's certainly not true about me. But yet, we stay. You know, maybe we're too embarrassed to leave. But we stay. And this staying is an expression of something we might not even know that we know. Chinul saying, do not seek outside of yourself. Something already present here, already functioning, without effort, invisible functioning. So we rely on this, sometimes consciously, sometimes not consciously. This is, sometimes we say, the way-seeking mind, that desire to wake up, the intention to not miss our lives, that sense of how precious it all is and how fleeting, and how strong the winds of karma, how strong the ancient habit patterns. Even with an awakening, even with the biggest Maha awakening that has ever happened, still there is the need to practice. So from awakening, then our expression of our awakening is a gradual cultivation, is breath after breath. And of course, this is all so provisional, because to talk of one and the other makes it sound like there are two things. Though there are two things, these two things are one thing. Practice enlightenment. Practice enlightenment. Practice enlightenment. Just the moment that is here to save us. The moment that is not separate. There is not me and the retreat. There is not me and how I'm doing. There is not me and the Sangha. There is the arising of life, this great Tao, this great gift that is given, that we don't earn or deserve, that we can never understand. It is mysterious and ungraspable, uncreated, unborn, and it is indestructible. It is undying. It is utterly reliable. So this is the manifestation. Each moment, the manifestation of our true life. And the encouragement and the direction is into this moment, into the suchness of the worry, into the experience of the joy. It's, we say, none of your business whether you are in an open state or a closed state. These states seem to come and go of their on their own time. But we do have the opportunity, we do have the choice, it seems, to turn toward, to say yes to what is happening, to move into the particular of our life as the meaning. There is no meaning outside of the sound of the fan. When we look somewhere else, we look in vain. So I encourage us all to hold to what we already know. Rely on something more than your opinion. Give yourself to your life. Give your heart. Give your whole love. Do not hold back. risk everything. Thank you. So I invite you to sit comfortably. You can stay where you are. It's fine. So this is the time for our Dharma dialogue, for questions, for associations that arose, for your experience of these matters. Yeah.
I find myself growing increasingly attached to non-attachment, unattachment. How do I absorb the teachings of the koans and of the readings without growing attached or growing attached to unattachment?
Kate will explain.
Well, you're noticing it, right? You're noticing that this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, maybe not totally buying into it. I would say that's the way in. When you see it come up, there it is. Maybe not quite believing it.
Thank you.
I would also add, slowly. That's how we let this in. We want it to come all at once.
Can you hear in the back?
No.
Slowly. The answer to how. Slowly. Haltingly. Someone asked the Buddha how he crossed the floodplain. And he said, not straining and not halting.
And you know, if you can't hear in the back, please say something. Just come forward and say, I can't hear, like Diane just did. What's that?
I'm going to turn the fan off now.
Oh, yeah. Good idea.
Yeah. The other thing that occurs to me too, Mark, is that part of what we see as we practice is the astonishing creativity of the grasping self. Right? It is infinitely marvelous because it will use anything. It doesn't care.
Or nothing.
Right, or nothing. Right, exactly. As you're saying, I'm really, you know. So I think, as Kate was saying, to the gift is to be able to see this is functioning all the time in our life. We're making stuff real and attaching to it. And we get to see and see how subtle it is.
Thanks.
Yeah, Mike.
So the thing I like to grasp on to is all the talk of in that reading, understanding. So you just understand your mind, then you've got it. So, and I love to understand things. And I get really frustrated when I don't. So what is he talking about?
You already know, Mike, that there's a lot of different kinds of understanding, right?
Yes. That's I guess what I'm learning. A lot has changed about what I think about different things like trusting. I guess understanding is one of those things. But I still ask.
You want to, yeah, you want to understand. And, you know, so just the general thing, and I think you already know this, is there's a kind of understanding that we're trained to value in our upbringing, our education, kind of, it could be an intellectual understanding or a mechanics understanding, you know, this is the way the world works, this is the way things are, what we sometimes call consensual reality understanding, right? That we all consense together that when it's hot, you can turn on a fan and that will cool you. You know, these are basic things, but little kids don't know this. But we grow in that kind of understanding, right? And then there's this, so it's like a body, intellect, like kind of common sense understanding. And Yamada referred to that. He said emptiness is not enough. Oneness and is a form of common sense understanding. Because there's a certain point where when we've been practicing like we practice here, something reveals itself to us that is not in the common consensus. You wouldn't find it in the, you know, the engineering textbook or the housekeeping textbook or whatever we study. Somebody was just telling me the other day, oh, an old man in his 80s who remembered his mother telling him that you should always do the silverware first. Right? That's a kind of consensual understanding. But this one that Chenil's pointing to, I don't think is that kind. It's this, it's what, you know, David in the talk was talking about, something that is so reliable that underlies everything, and it's really, really trustworthy, and there's some kind of understanding that grows in us about that. It's, you might call it a heart understanding, or words are inherently confining. But that's what's growing in you, right? And you sense into that.
And I guess that's why I still ask the question, because just what you just said there is, I experience this.
Yeah.
So I see something, but I can't express it. And so I still tell my story, well, if I'm having difficulty expressing it, I must not really understand it.
Right. Yeah, and that's the...
Right.
And that's what we were talking about yesterday too. You know, the when Pierce brought that up, and a number of you have said this privately and publicly, that there you get some "I get it" moment, and David referred to that as well. And then the mind of consensual reality, which is trained to box things and keep them in the closet piled up so you can get them when you need them. Or file them, or whatever metaphor you want to use, boxes, confines, and then we think, got it. But this other way of knowing isn't so amenable to that. And so I would encourage you to trust not being able to explain it. Yeah, I think it lasts longer that way. Thank you for that question.
Faye.
So I can't help relate this story to an article I read written by King Parrish. It was in the Atlantic. And it was about a guru in India who has either been in a state of samadhi or dead for the past 6 months. And they had to call in the state of India to help try to sort it out. And the doctor said he's dead, and his followers said no, he's in a really blissful state. So I ended up putting him in the freezer until I figured it out. And so,
whoa.
I remember just thinking when I read it too, like, oh, that is not the point, you know? even if this guru, you know, he might have this naughty thing down, even just like, that would get boring for 6 months. I'm sitting through, I mean, I would much rather be in a state of samadhi most of the time. But at the same time, like, it is interesting.
when One safety mechanism here at the temple is we have very small freezers. That won't happen.
Yeah. And I think that's the observation and the assertion of this whole koan and of the Zen school. And I think it's one of the things that really Zen is quite clear about this. It's not about some other special, you know, whatever we call it, samadhi or living in the freezer or, you know, who knows. But we're really insisting again and again on this ordinary miracle. You know, this, that there are not two separate worlds, and we're in this world and we have to get to the next. So nice so you read the article and you think, wow, that's not the point. You know, that's some kind of inner wisdom that develops. We see, well, yeah, what is the point? What do you really want? Well, I want to live. I'm not interested in something else. So, thank you.
And you know, the yearning for that freezer state is, as you said, like compared to this mess that I'm involved in, it is very human and leads us into dangerous waters that I think it's safe to say that the teachers in Boundless Way have learned not to value that for various reasons, because we've seen where it can go. And even just more ordinarily, the yearning for that leads to alcoholism, drug abuse, all kinds of addictions. And that yearning is so normal because it hurts to be a human being a lot of the time. It's really hard. And so, of course, we want to escape. And I want to say on the other side that samadhi is a real thing, but it's not an ultimate thing. It's like a thing that happens, just like being really restless is a thing that happens. It's an important thing that happens, but it's not what we're aiming for. You know, it allows certain other things to happen, but 6 months, not sure if you're dead or not, put you in the freezer, that's if that's your aim, make sure you check in with us in Dorksan. We'll be able to investigate that with you. Thank you. Back in the back.
Okay, yeah, in the back and then Pierce.
It just struck me, David, when you were talking about practice enlightenment, it seemed like an injunction, like you should practice enlightenment. And I just thought that
made a nice bumper sticker. That you should practice enlightenment and it'd make a nice bumper sticker.
$5 on your way out.
Yeah, right. New fundraiser, yeah. Pierce and then Michael.
I wanted to say, in response to what David said, that I find it encouraging to be told that we all have some experience of awakening. You know, we read and we are told that we have Buddha nature, we don't have to go anywhere. But sometimes I'm not encouraged by that. I don't feel it, obviously. But this is different, I think. I mean, it's different, it's the same. And for some reason, while you were talking, it put me in mind of the famous Pink Floyd song, Comfortably Numb. And comfortably numb, I mean, I guess that Roger Waters is saying, you can be comfortably numb. I don't know that anybody is really comfortably numb. I think there's something there that is looking to be heard. But it's the verse, one of the choruses. When I was a child, I caught a fleeting glimpse out of the corner of my eye. I turned my head and it was gone. I cannot put my finger on it, etc. And I think that, you know, we all have experiences like this. and it provides a kind of a powerful motivation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's exactly the same as what you're talking about as totally trustworthy. It's more fleeting in some sense. But to hear about this, that it's available, and then we've had it, you know. I mean, because it's easy to forget. It's easy to forget the taste of it because it's so unlike what we normally experience. But it's good to be, it's just good to be reminded. I appreciate the reminder.
Yeah. I want to pick up one piece of what you said early on there. So we all have this Buddha nature, you said, and then you said, but I don't feel it, obviously. I don't see it, obviously. And but the thing is you do see it. It just doesn't look the way you're expecting it to look. It's not according with your prior view. It's arising in this moment as, oh my God, I totally don't have Buddha nature. That is it. That is the form it takes.
Michael and then Christine.
I was wondering if you could, anyone, say a little more about your closing words, risk everything.
I'll say a few more after you, because clearly it touched, meant something to you.
Well, it was like a little koan direction or something for me. It was like a little, a little puzzle. And I don't mean it as a technique. I mean it as a touching in my heart. So I guess for me, I do find, I've been finding in during this retreat that I've been feeling a strong sense of possession around certain things that has been painful. And so when you said risk, when you say risk everything, there's a letting go that's possible there, that's very very sad and very beautiful at the same time.
Yeah.
So that's what it brought up to me.
There's one saying that my teacher George says, and I don't know what tradition he got it from. I think it might have been from his teacher, but it's you give a little, you get a little. If you give a lot, you get a lot. And if you give everything, you get everything. And I think this is, we're always playing some kind of dodge. Well, I'll try pretty hard, but, you know, it'll be over in 6 days. or, you know, the bell's going to ring in a little bit. I'm going to coast a little bit here. But this, you know, playing for keeps kind of, you know, that our life asks, demands, wants, us to meet it fully. And we're continually trying to, we can't strategize that because that's not meeting it fully. So there is this moving into that we can't know how to do. Yeah.
And, you know, this concept of risking everything, letting it go, the consensual mind hears that and thinks there'll be some loss.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's what makes me cry.
Maybe. But it is awesome to have tasted even a little bit of letting go and see how powerfully it allows room for something else to enter. And that something else is not what we expect. But, you know, when David was quoting George, I thought of the song Magic Penny. Do you know that song?
I think I do.
It's just like a magic penny. Hold it tight and you won't have any.
Oh.
Lend it, spend it. You'll have so many. they'll roll all over the floor. And it's by Malvina Reynolds, a singer who basically says that that the world is made out of love.
Yeah.
So love doesn't operate the way consensual reality operates. The more it's given, the faster. And this is, you know, the glimpse that Pierce was talking about of the inherently trustworthy thing. The glimpses are small for sometimes they're big, but it's one reason why the Pali word for mindfulness actually means remember. It doesn't mean to be mindful or pay attention or anything like that. It just means remember this. Don't forget. So the door opens. Mm. Let's see what happens. Mm. Thank you.
Christine and then Maddie. Yeah.
So the scary part for me, yesterday what kept coming up is how can this be it? And the risk of sharing who I am behind the mask, and like, you know, I should know this, you ignoramus, you know, I mean, haven't you been learning this for so long? And then just sharing that surprisingly opened just exactly joy. I mean, this joy that I'm like, go figure. And then I don't know how I can verbal it, but the love that's all around and just opening to that and not who I should be, I you know, whatever, I'm just a big surprise.
Yeah. Wow, really well said, Christine.
How can that be?
Thank you. Maddie.
So I guess I just have an anecdote. Can everyone hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. So a lot of the time when hard things come up, my... now that I've been practicing for many, many, what, like 2 years or something. One of my first instincts is to sort of just be like, okay, I'm gonna sit. I'm gonna, like, you know, mentally or physically or whatever, just I'm gonna like zen my way through whatever's happening. And maybe I won't enter samadhi or the freezer, but I will at least like just be with whatever's happening. And so this morning, during Samu, this is a pretty tangible example of this, I guess. I was dusting the stairs, and I found a small nail. And I was like, oh, it seems like no one stepped on it yet. That's good. I should probably put it somewhere so people continue to not step on it and hurt themselves. And so I was going to throw it out, and then it just ended up in my pocket. And then I put it on the ladder by my bed. And I was like, oh, I'll get this before I leave the room. And I forgot. And then we came down here and had the sutra service. And after that, or before, or whatever, I was just like, oh, shit. Like, I need to make sure that, like, people don't, like, get hurt from that thing that I left there very, like, intending to move it and just forgetting. And so I was considering my options. I was like, I could keep sitting like the whole day and just get it later and like hope that the dangerous thing I left there won't hurt anyone. But it was a really good practice for me to notice when to leave kinging, even though that's what we're supposed to, quote unquote, supposed to be doing. Leave and just like take it and like wrap it up and throw it out. Instead of trying to mentally be okay with the fact that I left something dangerous there. And so that's just kind of, that was like a little thing that just kind of felt important in that sort of skillful action. Versus.
That works very, very well for nails. And wrapping it up and throwing it out can seem so tempting for kind of the big messes of our life. But in fact, it's only effective for nails.
lost.
Not groundhogs.
And to distinguish that we're not talking about a quietism here where we do nothing. That's so important, you know, to wrap up the nail and throw it away. So thank you for bringing that. Such an important thing we should never forget. This is not about stepping away from the world and just zenning it out. You know, this is about engaging in the fire and taking bodhisattva action when there's a nail.
And you know what I enjoyed, Maddie, about your story is the space between, because we can't strategize what we're going to do with our nails or our pain or whatever it is, but we can hang out with the dilemma long enough so that we know something more about it, and then can skillfully move into it, which is what you did. And you know, the other skillful action would have been to get it later. There's so many choice points in that whole story, right? So this is the thing that I think we learn. 25 minutes of sitting still means that we're not going to interrupt unless there's an emergency, and we get to really see what's the thing that I need to do right now. And for those 25 minutes, the answer is nothing. Except be with it. Be fully with it.
It's tempting to use Zazen to fix things. Mm-hmm. And the thing that makes it so complicated and confusing is that it works a little bit some of the time. And because it works a little bit some of the time, we think it can work all of it all of the time if only we were better at it. But it actually only ever works a little bit some of the time. The thing that works all of the time is this thing that David has called out as utterly reliable. This entrusting ourselves to this reality as it in fact is, entrusting ourselves to Buddha nature arising as this confusion. Entrusting ourselves.
No, go ahead. Entrusting ourselves. Keep going.
to the thing that is okay regardless of the content of our little state of consciousness, or our big state of consciousness, or our frozen state of consciousness.
And even hearing this, the consensual mind, I almost guarantee it, is going in, and it kept hearing the word works. And we're going to make some definition about what that means, which we don't mean when we use a word like that. We mean something else. But the mind goes, yes, okay, I'm going to get this to work. So this is a constant reevaluation of everything without any exceptions. And if you're willing to live that way, you're in the right place.
So Julie, and then Jeannie, and then we'll finish up.
Somewhat related to what Josh said a minute ago, but I heard the words risk everything a little bit differently, in that ultimately we really don't have any choice about it. I was totally unaware of risking everything when I got on my bike a couple weeks ago. Yeah. I just got banged up, but I could have broken my neck. Mm-hmm. You know, we are all, the five remembrances, everything that I love is of the nature of change.
Yeah.
So there's both of that.
Yeah.
That's something that is extremely trustworthy, and that fact we can't trust anything in our conceptual.
Yeah.
Oh. And risking everything is actually aligning with the universe.
That's how we touch into that thing that we could.
Right. When we resist, that's aligning. Yeah, this is a constant state.
Yeah.
Yes, can you really know that?
Yeah. That you're right, as if we have a choice. So we pretend, well, I'm playing it safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she played it so safe. Yeah, so it is. I love that. So aligning with what is already true. Our life is already...
unsafe.
Yeah, unsafe.
I don't know how I was going to go. And Andrew's for you. And Josh is going to say.
So your point about risking everything, well, we're already risking everything. You know, and this is related to letting go. We should let go, but that's actually far too much. And instead we should let be. But even let be, this letting is far too active. Nobody's asked us. And that is what we entrust ourselves to.
So, Jeannie.
Listening to this conversation this morning, it makes me very grateful for this Sangha, because what we're talking about is pretty scary stuff. Being present with how it is. And I realize that I've kind of gone through these downshifts from when I was younger, really being very attached to samadhi, and going through a whole long yoga period where bliss was it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then coming into Zen practice, where I sort of shifted into, okay, so, you know, sometimes life is yucky, so I'll train myself to have samadhi in the yuck. And I'm beginning to understand a lot what Josh has been pointing to the last few days, that sometimes, you know, I think I was very attached to being cool, not making mistakes, not being off my center, and being in the safety of a sangha that lets me be a klutz, you know, that lets me really screw up badly, is of great value to me, is healing me. So it's not just the words or the philosophy, it's the reality of being surrounded by very loving people who hold me in that and train me in that. So that allows me to be fully however it is.
A wonderful way to end. Thank you.